Dr. Steve Mickelson is a local boy made good. He was educated locally and lived in Tolworth and is now the reader in 20th century contemporary drama at Sheffield University. And he has published 2 volumes on the history of censorship in the 20th century. And the third is coming
In about a year's time.
It takes a long time ploughing through the archives of the Lord Chamberlain.
Thanks very much. As a break from my voice as I'm talking, Sam has kindly agreed to read a few quotations and extracts just so they stand out a bit more. Yes, as Sam says, it is a huge task going through all the Lord Chamberlain's papers. This is what I've been working on censorship for about 15 years now, I suppose. And one of the interesting things to me is that for most of that time I thought I was doing something completely historical and in the past and fascinating, but you know, something that was now over. And of course censorship is now very much back as an issue that's being debated, as demonstrated I think by a number of you who've come today. So what I'm going to try to do is to give a kind of an overview of some of Lord Chamberlain's activity in relation to censorship in the 20th century up until 1968, which is where I've mostly worked. I mean, I have looked at some older stuff as well, but I've worked mostly on the 1900 to 1968 period. And as I'm sure a lot of you know, every play between 1737 and 1968, every new play had to be submitted to the Lord Chamberlain for a licence, and that made no difference whether it was a commercial West End play or a play that the Women's Institute was putting on or a group of students were putting on. Any new play had to be submitted for licence. What that means is that the Lord Chamberlain's archive, which has been preserved, has something like 300 boxes with about 150 files in each one, with a file for each play. And I'm pretty certain that I'm the only person who's read through all of them. Sometimes quite skimpily, but I have read them all. And there's another dimension to his archive as well, which is still in the Royal Archive at Windsor Castle, which I've also looked at, which is all his material, which is not just to do with specific individual plays, but broader policy issues. And I've been through that as well. So I'm going to try and give an overview and perhaps focus particularly, because it seems pertinent, on issues to do with religion and intercultural sensitivity. I want to say a few important general things before I start to focus. First is censorship, theatre censorship was not abolished in 1968. Justice system was abolished. Obviously, at one level, all laws are censorship, and of course, there are all sorts of other pressures, not least financial, that control what's put on and what isn't. So, not for a minute would I say censorship was abolished in 1968. Second thing I want to say in the introduction is that it's probably important to recognise that nobody in Britain in the 20th century lost their lives as a result of theatre censorship, or was even imprisoned, as of course did happen in some parts of the world. They may have had their careers damaged, they may have been fined, but it's in the global scale of things, I suppose it's a relatively, well, it's a very British form of control. Third thing I want to say is that despite all the files I've been through, I don't think they begin to show the full extent of censorship. I think they're the tip of the iceberg, because censorship is at its most effective when it's invisible, when it's self-censorship. And various playwrights talk about, in documents I've seen, talk about the unwritten plays that they never produced. And writers who chose not to write for the theatre talk about why they're not writing for the theatre, and it's because of censorship. Hubert Griffith, the playwright in the 30s, talks about all the unborn children, meaning the plays that he would have liked to write. Now it's impossible to measure that. There's no way I can look at that. We only ever see the stuff that's actually been censored. But of course, if you were trying to make a living as a playwright, you were by and large not going to write a play that was unlikely to be put on. And anyway, you first submitted it to a theatre manager, and it was a manager who sent it to the Lord Chamberlain. So there's a level of censorship that comes in there between the manager and the playwright. And then, of course, self-censorship by the playwright. And just the first example Sam's going to read is just a quotation from, I think this was Arnold Bennett, one of the many playwrights who at the 1909 the government had a select committee in which it explored the issue of censorship, and several playwrights talked about how they felt silenced, and I think this one was Arnold Bennett.
Immediately you begin to get near the things that really matter in a play, you begin to think about the censor, and it's all over with your play. That is why I would not attempt to write a play at full emotional power.
Thank you. Next general point in the introduction. I'm sometimes asked whether I found a lot of great plays that were silenced. The implication being that, well, maybe censorship didn't matter unless you can find lots of really great plays that were silenced. Well, partly for reasons that I've just mentioned there and in that quotation. It's not just an issue of whether there are great plays that have been silenced. I have found some good plays that were prevented from being performed, or that were delayed for a very long time, or that were amended, because it's important to say that there's a relatively small number of plays that were banned completely and outright. And the Lord Chamberlain always liked to describe himself as a licenser of plays rather than a censor. There's maybe only, I don't know, on average, perhaps four plays a year that are seen as so outrageous that they are totally banned forever. But what happened much more frequently, I think in probably up to a third of cases, was that amendments were made to plays in negotiation usually between the Lord Chamberlain and the manager of the theatre. Sometimes just a single word, sometimes a whole character, sometimes costumes, sometimes even lighting effects were amended. Sometimes plays were only licensed 20 or 30 years after they'd been written, arguably when they were no longer dangerous. So you don't begin to understand the scale of censorship if you only go to Lord Chamberlain's archive and look at plays that are listed under ban. Miss Julie, Strindberg's Miss Julie, is a play that was banned for 20 or 30 years and is then licensed. Partly it was banned because of the suggestion of an aristocratic woman having a sexual relationship with a working class man. For 20 years that was seen as too dangerous to allow on the stage. Also the fact that she mentions her period at a certain point, those are two things. But it doesn't appear as a banned play because in the end it's allowed. Next general point I want to make is that I don't myself, having gone through all these files, I don't go along with the view that's sometimes put across that the Lord Chamberlain and everybody who worked in his office were a bunch of fools. I don't think they were at all. I think they sometimes play that role, and they're quite jokey in the debates they have with writers and with managers. But they're not idiots at all, and the kind of image of aristocratic upper-class guardsman who knows nothing at all is not fair and accurate. Okay, I'll just say briefly how the system worked and what its basic approach was. So all new plays had to be submitted to the Lord Chamberlain from 1737, when the Act had been introduced, and 1843 it was confirmed. Its origins are in political censorship, because the Prime Minister in the 1737 Walpole didn't like satires on the stage, so its origins were directly political. You sent the manager had to send the play in then to the Lord Chamberlain. Lord Chamberlain himself didn't read it usually. He had readers who got a fee, I think it was a guinea per play, for reading the play through and writing a synopsis and a report and drawing attention to anything that the reader thought the Lord Chamberlain should look at. And I worked out that a reader was probably a lot of the time reading maybe three full-length plays a day and writing a synopsis and report on them for a few guineas. So it's actually amazing how accurate they often are in their synopses. So there's the Lord Chamberlain's readers who look at it. There's also in the Lord Chamberlain's office he had someone called a controller, an assistant controller, who might come in after the reader if the reader had drawn attention to things. And only then would it normally go to the Lord Chamberlain if there was a particular issue. He also had an advisory board, which he, the Lord Chamberlain, selected, of sort of distinguished, what he saw as distinguished people to whom he could send scripts for advice, usually civil servants, ex-MPs, people of public letters, you might say. But he was not bound to accept their advice. He also, and this was kind of completely unknown really, and hidden, he also quite regularly consulted anybody he wanted to consult, which would include the Foreign Office, if it was an international play, the Home Office, the War Office, colonial offices, the King on occasions, certainly the Archbishop of Canterbury and other religious leaders. So he would regularly send letters out to them. One of the kind of details that I think most shocked me when I found it was that right through the 1930s, any play that mentioned Germany or the Nazis, Lord Chamberlain sent to the German embassy, and you could not get a play on the stage that was critical of Germany or that put Adolf Hitler on the stage or that was anyway nasty about the Nazi Party and fascism. The reason for that was, the reason he consulted the German embassy, and this is a really important point I think about theatre censorship, is that the Lord Chamberlain was the head of the monarch's household. Any play that he licensed was therefore seen as having the stamp of royal approval. And again, various playwrights talk sometimes about how theatre is a national act. If you say something, it's not acceptable that it's your individual opinion as a playwright. It's been licensed and therefore approved by the monarch. And that's why, one of the reasons why they were so concerned that Germany in the 30s should not think that the British king was being nasty about them. In 1909, as I've mentioned, the government set up this select committee to investigate the whole issue of theatre censorship. By and large, playwrights were against theatre censorship, with a few exceptions. By and large, theatre managers were in favour of the system of theatre censorship. And that was so right through until the 1960s, when there are isolated examples of managers who challenged it earlier, but most managers liked the system because it gave them a licence, because they knew if their play, the piece they were in control of and for which they were responsible, had a licence by the Lord Chamberlain, from the Lord Chamberlain, and effectively from the monarch, it was very hard for them to be prosecuted or for anyone to complain about it. So managers liked the system, especially if they were touring shows. They didn't want to get into a situation where what was acceptable in one city was then banned the following week in Oldham and Newcastle, have a reputation for being particularly tough with their local magistrates, actually. So it gave them a kind of licence. That 1909 Select Committee came up with a list of recommendations, which sounds good to read, right? Yes.
It should be his duty to license any plays submitted to him unless he considers that it may reasonably be held to be indecent, to contain offensive personalities, to represent on the stage in an invidious manner a living person or any person recently dead, to do violence to the sentiment of religious reverence, to be calculated to condone, to conduce to crime or vice, to be calculated to impair friendly relations with any foreign power, or to be calculated to cause a breach of the peace.
Thank you. Now, obviously, that leaves open masses of different interpretations of who decides what is and isn't going to cause a breach of the peace or doing damage to religious reverence or whatever. But the other important thing to say is that none of that was binding on the Lord Chamberlain, because there was no legislation that followed those recommendations. So although you could probably say that he generally used those as guidelines, he still had the absolute power to forbid a play on any grounds that he chose. He was not obliged to follow those. He was not answerable to anyone, not even in Parliament, because he was from the King's household. He did not have to give a reason for banning anything. He usually did. He usually did. Was willing to kind of go into discussion with managers and even playwrights, but he wasn't obliged to, and he wasn't. You know, he could act absolutely on whim. As I mentioned, it was only new plays that were subject to this system of censorship. That included, however, any new translations of Greek plays, so Oedipus was banned for quite a long time. You could have performed it in ancient Greek, in English you have to get a license. And one of the other things I've just sort of picked up in reading around is that this culture of censorship, in fact, extended unofficially over other plays as well. So there's a parliamentary debate in, I think it's about 1926, on theatre censorship, in which an MP complains about certain scenes in Shakespeare, and he mentions the nurse scenes in Romeo and Juliet, that he's never been able to see in Britain. He has to go to Germany if he wants to see those being performed. There was a production of the restoration play The Country Wife at Hampstead, I think again it was in the 20s. And I don't know exactly what was cut, but what I've seen is a letter from the theatre saying, we've already cut a third of this, is it now okay to perform it? And Lord Chamberlain says, well, actually, you don't even need to send it to me, but I'm glad you're cutting a third of it. During the Second World War, Lord Chamberlain got very uptight about finding that a play called Tis Pity She's a Whore was being performed, even though, of course, it's a 17th century John Ford play. Pericles, Shakespeare's Pericles, performed in the Second World War. Again, it's going to be performed in the open air at Regent's Park. The manager sent it in to the Lord Chamberlain for advice, even though he says, I know I don't have to consult you because it's an old play, but would you tell me which bits you think we should cut, bearing in mind it's going to be an open air performance? So although officially it's only new plays, part of the culture that extends is, I think, much broader than that. Very, very broadly, you could probably divide the Lord Chamberlain's censorship, and it's an unsatisfactory division, but you could broadly divide it into politics, morality, and religion. And of course those overlap with each other, they're not definitive. It was very important, as I've said, not to upset international allies, but the Lord Chamberlain was also aware of cultural and political ramifications in relation to the British Empire. I'll just give a couple of examples of that, which may perhaps just pick them out because it felt like they had a little pertinence at the moment. And they may also invite us. It would be very easy for me, I think, just to totally denigrate the Lord Chamberlain and say, look at this, isn't this ridiculous, isn't this awful? He's part of a much broader culture and context. It's not to do just with the Lord Chamberlain. And there may be some areas of sensitivity where at least one can see why he's acting as he was. So in 1921, there was a spectacular musical submitted for the London stage under the title of Mecca. And its appeal was the exoticism of, and I quote, the gorgeous eastern scenes and dresses and unlimited local colour. Now, Lord Chamberlain's office was concerned that the title might cause offence. I quote, possibly Mohammedans might object to the Mecca pilgrimage being taken lightly, he said. Not to mention the fact that the pilgrims were shown drinking alcohol, which is ignorance if you like on the part of the authors. Lord Chamberlain had a meeting with Mustafa Khan, a religious leader, and with the British MP Amir Ali, and the title was changed from Mecca to Cairo. And the Islamic Review of Muslim India wrote to the Lord Chamberlain to thank him for the sympathy which you have showed to the interests of Muslims in connection with the safeguard of their religious feelings. Censorship, political correctness, or cultural sensitivity in the face of imperialist ignorance in, you know, showing local colour and pilgrims getting drunk on their way to Mecca. Following year, early 20s, a licence was refused for a play about the Turkish-Armenian conflict, which is in the news at the moment because of the vote of French MPs. And it was a play which referred to and depicted Turkish atrocities. And the performance was specifically designed to encourage audiences to help Armenian refugees. The office was concerned that the play was anti-Turkish and that Mohammedans would be offended. Mohammedans in quotes. The historical accuracy was irrelevant. This is a quote from Lord Chamberlain's archive. Though the whole world is aware of Turkish atrocities on Armenians, it would be inadvisable for the Lord Chamberlain to countenance the advertising of them, having regard to India and Muslim problems within the empire. There was also an issue in that British foreign policy was implicitly criticised within the play. So they insisted on a revised version, which removes specific references to Turks, to Allah, and to Muhammad. The Islamic Review put more pressure on the Lord Chamberlain to reject it. This is a quote from the Islamic Review, their letter. The whole production constitutes a shameless and libelous attack on the principles and the faith of Islam. And the knowledge that such a performance is being permitted here in England with the sanction of the authorities is likely to create a very painful, I may say disastrous, impression among Muslims in every land. They demanded that the performance be suppressed, and they warned that otherwise peaceful relations and goodwill between Christians and Muslims would be threatened. And I quote again from the letter. The British Muslim Society had unanimously resolved to some form of public action. My position, this is from an imam, my position enables me to judge the state of public feeling among Muslims generally, and Indian Muslims in particular. The thoughtless exploitation of reckless and unprincipled propaganda, which English audiences may or may not take seriously, may well, in the hands of anti-British agitators, become a very serious obstacle. That's about the empire, really. There were other pressures on him from the other side to license that play, and in fact they did license it after further alterations, which made it absolutely clear that the forces carrying out these atrocities, these tortures, were, I quote, brigands of no identifiable nationality.
Methodists.
Sometimes what was allowed by the Lord Chamberlain can be as interesting as what was banned. Generally, what were seen as displays of exoticism in the empire, especially India, were allowed, provided there was not seen to be a political dimension or implication. But in 1930, a Drury Lane-like musical comedy about an evil Indian prince opposing British rule in India was refused a license under pressure from the India Office because of the immediate context in which there were several Indian princes attending a round table meeting in London to discuss the future of India. Quote from the archive, it would be highly impolitic to produce a play of this description, which is so liable to misinterpretation by Indians and in India. The managing director of the theatre was himself a serving Conservative MP, Sir Alfred Butt, and he agreed at a meeting with Lord Chamberlain to amend it.
Sir Alfred quite understood this objection and is going to change the setting of the piece to a more vague and mythical part of Turkestan, or somewhere possibly on the borders of Persia. He expressed his desire to introduce a Persian element, if possible, in order to make use of Persian dresses and colouring. He also spoke of introducing into the plot some foreign menace from Russia. I told him that in avoiding the objections of the India office, I did not wish him to run into a further from the Foreign Office, so I begged him to be careful as regards anything that was likely to be offensive to foreign countries, even the Russians. Although Bolsheviks deserve no sympathy. My indications to him were to make this play as fantastic and impersonal as possible, more reminiscent of the Arabian Nights.
Yet, at the same time, the stages of London and the regions were full of melodramas with the most evil Chinese villains duping and doping innocent English girls, luring them into opium dens. In 1921, even the Lord Chamberlain's reader expressed his surprise that the Chinese authorities did not make an official complaint about plays which were liable to stir up hatred of the Chinese. In 1925, the Chinese Council did complain about a melodrama in which the central character was a villain who had the mysterious ability to look at will either a Chinese or an Englishman. The Lord Chamberlain rejected their complaint, and he actually obtained an official apology from the Chinese consulate for their having complained about this. And that genre continued into the 1930s. I suppose those of us, and obviously I would count myself, who are instinctively, naturally opposed to censorship, might have to ask ourselves, well, just suppose somebody wanted to stage those plays today, those anti-Chinese racist plays, you know, how would I then react? In relation to one example of these plays in which a Chinese villain seduces an innocent white woman, Lord Chamberlain said it might be useful as a warning to white women who are foolish enough to be beguiled by Chinamen. We make no bones about discountenancing Anglo-Chinese matrimonial alliances. It's of course highly unlikely that a play would have been allowed, even if anyone could have written one, which celebrated interracial marriage. I think one of the again, an example that kind of shocked me. There are quite a lot of plays you come across set in the 1920s and 30s, set in Africa. They're kind of Heart of Darkness plays in a way, or they're about, you know, the British going abroad and being destroyed by the heat and by the seductive wiles of black African women. And there's one particular play, I can't remember its name at the moment, in which a white Englishman working in Africa, his fiancée from England comes out to visit him, and she is, we gather, raped off stage, we hear the screams, by his black servant, because the assumption is that the male black Africans can't resist English white women. And Lord Chamberlain debates for some time whether this sound of the screaming from off stage is too shocking and the implication of the rape. And in the end, they allow this, and I haven't got the exact quotation here, but they say in effect, it is not as shocking as it would have been if the woman had been willing to have a relationship. So had it been a willing relationship, they would not have given the license.
It's Miss Julie, isn't it?
Yeah, yes.